I'm Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll welcome Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Sean Mullins, whose latest album is My Stupid Heart. In addition to answering my silly love song questions, the Atlanta native will also be performing two new songs live right here, The Great Unknown and Pre-Apocalyptic Blues. Stick around. It all comes down. It all comes down. It all comes down to love. If you're looking for a troubadour whose songs of love and the road might speak to your heart, you've come to the right place today. My guest, Sean Mullins, has just released a new album full of longing and places, some with a little of both. And if you don't know his work, I wonder if you'll hear the influences that I do, ranging from the mirth and joy of George Harrison and Warren Zevon to the intensity and the message of Bob Dylan and even a little of Michael Frank's romantic spice. Or I could be way, way off on that, but that's why I'm going to talk to the man in just a moment. My Stupid Heart is, by my count, Mullins' 16th release, and it's packed full of songs such as the title tune, And It All Comes Down to Love, and Pre-Apocalyptic Blues, songs that you'll be singing or humming along with by the second play. And of course, there's the more serious plaint of Ferguson, which reflects the agony of the Missouri city. Now, Mullins is on tour through at least the end of spring that I know of, including a 4-day birthday bash appearance in Duluth, Georgia in early March, and participation in the Safety Harbor Songfest on April 3rd right here in the Tampa Bay, Florida area. Today, he'll be performing two songs, The Great Unknown and Pre-Apocalyptic Blues. And with that, Sean Mullins, welcome to Mr. Meat.
Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Delighted to have you here. Very excited to... I know everybody wants me to shut up and get right to the playing, but we're going to talk a little bit. And I want to start with kind of the serious side of My Stupid Heart, and that's the song Ferguson. There's a line in there, the blood we all bleed is the same shade of red. And it seems like you're saying a pretty clear message to me. But at the same time, in the song itself, you don't mention the city. You don't mention Michael Brown. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts as you're constructing that song.
Well, the song started off in a North Georgia cotton field, and it was the actual same cotton field that my grandmother had picked cotton in as a kid. And when she was 13, she left that area and moved to Atlanta. And then that since then, my dad's generation and then mine, there was a serious feeling of the loss of one's culture when I stood there in that field, because I didn't even recognize the blooming poppy-like plant of cotton in the summer. I'd never even seen that in my life before that I could remember. And so that was kind of odd. So the song, you know, I think it is, I'll give you a little of it.
Sure.
All of ye fallen fathers and mothers, I hear you calling from deep in your graves. So that was all there. It all just kind of like came in, you know, like songs do sometimes, they fly in. And I held on to that. You know, the next trip to Nashville wasn't maybe a day or two later. By the time I got to Nashville, the whole Ferguson thing was breaking out. Excuse me. I was hearing it on the radio and on my drive up, and I'd stopped in a truck stop and watched a little bit on the TV. I was like, wow, this is really nuts. I didn't even know this was going on, you know. I spend so much time on the highways and in music, you know, either music stores, you know, or I just typically don't pay attention. So it was like a kind of a wow, you know, moment. By the time I reached Nashville, more lines were coming to the song, but they were changed, the meaning was being changed, you know, without me even knowing. So Chuck Cannon and I finished that song. We worked on it most of that night. And we talked about the angle of the song, the voice of the song. Is it just about Ferguson? We knew we wanted to call it that so that it would be a reminder in history to go, this is a song that represents the time that we were in as a people. And I say a people, I mean Americans. when I'm saying that word. And so, like, all of us. And the whole path of it from the beginning is really what that song is. So it's not really about just Ferguson, but we titled it to almost put a little tag, you know, time tag on it, saying, now here we are right now, and the war still rages on, and the whole thing is rotten, and the blood we all bleed is the same shade of red. It's about race relations, it's about the lack thereof, it's about how we separate ourselves from each other, and there's still a lot of that, and there's still a lot of injustice, of course, and there's also there's other arguments on it too that I totally am confused. I never can say one way or the other how I feel, you know, when it comes to like police brutality. Obviously, no one wants that. I got a feeling, because I've known a lot of police officers over the years, my guess is that most of them are not practicing that, you know, what they're doing that way. I just don't believe that. So I think it's a very small percentage, and that's getting a lot of attention. But still, the fact that it's happening and that people can be profiled that way and it lead to a violent situation just because the color of someone's skin is pretty screwed up. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where that song, even though we're not talking about any particular place or event or a person even, it's the whole picture. And it starts from the beginning with the slave ships, you know, sailed the great ocean, sold down the river, sold down the Mississippi, working all the way down, you know, white fields of cotton to green fields of cane. So that's kind of the vibe. It wasn't just about Ferguson, but we decided to title it that. And of course, a lot of people said, oh man, don't name it that. Don't name it that. And that kind of made us want to call it that even more.
So. Now there's two, it seems to me that there's two things working in different directions here. One is that you're a white guy, but the other thing is you are from Atlanta, and I'm guessing you have probably seen the type of things that have gone on, or seen, not right firsthand maybe, but being in the community, you're aware that things are not always equal between the races and the police and you know, folks. So I'm guessing that Atlanta gave you a perspective that maybe some other people in New York or Boston or other places might not have.
Maybe. I mean, certainly Atlanta has had its issues with that stuff. You know, you had Katherine Johnston, gosh, probably what, a decade or so ago. You know, I think it's a small percentage in general, but I think it's also still wrong, and we've still got to figure that out. But yeah, I mean, race relations in the South are still, I think it is different still than it is in the rest of the country. There is a little more tension. I even feel it because I'm a white guy. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. I think that's to be expected to some degree. I mean, I didn't grow up rich by any means. We were right in the middle, I would say, if anything, closer to lower middle class. My dad worked for the railroad, and my mom was a school teacher, so they had good jobs with insurance. And I think that in itself is a big difference than a lot of the, you know, kids of color I grew up with. I think it was a different deal. I still remember M2M transfer when they were transferring minority to majority schools so that they could give them a better opportunity and be taught by better teachers, and also mix in with white kids. That was literally what they were doing still. And this is in the late 70s and early 80s. So yes, and we've come a long way, and we've still got a long way to go.
Now, I'm be honest, I don't know your entire catalog, and 25 years is a lot of songs there.
Me either.
Well, okay. Have you done this type of song before? Has something hit you emotionally like this before that you've gotten that catalog?
Well, I think early on I sang, I think in my early 20s I was more, I don't know, I wouldn't say I was more politically minded, but I was quicker to put that stuff in my music. you know, if I believed in something strongly, the first kind of intuition, I'd go with that. What I've learned as a songwriter over the years is that, yes, pleasing yourself as the artist is important to get out those, whatever that is, but dealing with a subject or an ideal or something that affects a lot of people other than yourself is the key to a good song too. You know, you got to move people. Just because it moves you as a singer and a writer, it might not move everybody else. It may, you know. So that is part of it. You know, you find key things that people want to hear. And I think some of it also, though, you mentioned a song like Ferguson is different for me because, you know, it's a co-write. So I wrote it with Chuck Cannon. And when Chuck and I write together, it's a whole other thing than anyone else that I write with, or when I write by myself, for sure. Hmm. But when I write by myself, it's the closest thing to writing with Chuck. It's a similar feeling. That, and I don't know, we have a real interesting chemistry, or we don't, I don't know how we lock into a thing where we can answer each other, you know, and that happened a lot with these songs. Well, I don't know, to answer your question, no, I haven't done it a ton, and I think it's because that Chuck and I were really interested in the challenge of writing that.
And the timeliness of it, it was happening right before your eyes.
Right.
I spent a lot of time over the weekend listening to My Stupid Heart, and so this song kept coming up, and it reminded me of the first song that I could recall growing up as a teen, that was kind of a protest song. And it doesn't sound anything like it, but it reminded me of Dylan's Hurricane about Reuben Carter.
And that's cool.
Yeah, so that's why I mentioned Dylan in the beginning, and I wanted to start with this. Yeah, I was thinking of that.
Like the death of Hattie Carroll, and yeah, that's one of my favorites of the early Dylan stuff too. That era, that kind of where he's speaking about real stuff. Of course, he was going into specific people, like, you know, and Medgar Evers and all that. It was amazing. I would love to hear someone doing that more now. You know, it's not, I've never felt like, I think stories are important for me to the degree where I want to put in some stuff that is in the imagination. And it's not always just a history thing, but I love mixing real history in. I love kind of writing from a perspective of, let's say, 150 or 200 years back. You know, I've done that a bunch, and I love doing that.
Mm. Well, one of the other themes, and we'll come to the love songs in a minute, but one of the other themes that I picked up on, I think, was the new album references plenty of places. I mean, Ferguson, obviously, but Portland and Alabama and Oakland, which suggested to me that you either get inspired by the road or you keep a map nearby when writer's block hits and you throw a lot of darts. So I'm wondering which it is.
Oh, it's definitely the first. It's definitely that, you know, when you do this, you get to see a lot of places, and sometimes you get just enough of a taste of a different city than you're used to that you kind of connect with whatever you're there for, just for that time. They're like little, you know, to me they're like little snapshots, and I take those with me. Sometimes I journal about them. Sometimes I just kind of hang on to them, and because I'll remember them, and then that can start a song. Or just from the literal travel that you do, you know what towns are nearby. You know, like when Max and I were writing Gambler's Heart, he came to me with, "Oh brother, let me take my rest and leave this wild and wicked west." And I was like, "Woo."
Yeah, that's a great line.
And I was like, "Man, you inviting me in on that?" And he was like, "Yeah." So I already knew that if it's in America, we're going to be talking about the West, and it had this vibe to it. And so, yeah, we made it kind of around the time of the San Francisco Gold Rush and all that. And then we tried to pick towns that would be nearby, and he mentioned that Steve Earle had a song called Calico, and so we looked that up, and yeah, sure enough, that was one of those old towns. And went, hey, well, let's tip of the hat to Steve Earle without ripping him off,
right?
you know, which is part of the thing too. We love kind of honoring those that are the mentors to us, you know. So
I always enjoy the Johnny Cash's "I've Been Everywhere," Matt. You know.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I think that was one of those things where he was throwing darts at the map, going, "Let me see, I've been all these places. Why don't I just make up a list and reorder the town so that they rhyme?"
Right.
Is there any particular song that over time has inspired you more than any other?
A song in particular? Or
no, a place. Like, is there any place that you've been that has inspired you to write, you know, more songs or references?
The Northwest. For some reason, the Northwest. Just kind of, it's always been a place that I want to write when I'm there.
Hmm.
I don't know why that is.
Interesting.
And the West Coast in general can be that way for me. I don't know if it's the laid back nature of the people, or if it's the landscape or the air. I don't know what it is. The water, maybe.
All right.
You know, I love the ocean. Whenever I'm near that, I feel kind of a little bit freer with, you know, the creative stuff. And
cool. Well, are you feeling a song? Coming
sure.
up? Well,
yeah.
The first song that Sean is going to play for us is The Great Unknown. Do you want to set this up at all, or do you want to just jump in?
Well, you know, basically in all little towns around the world, there's someone sitting in the corner bar there, you know, stuffed into the corner with an acoustic guitar or a keyboard or whatever, tip jar. Terrible looking stage, you know, that's got God knows what in the thick shag carpet there, and you know, there's just, the song starts at that stage and it works itself out until by the end of it you're kind of out there in space somewhere. So it's called The Great Unknown. I'm back again, with my old guitar and my trusty grin, and a "best you don't come in here" sign tattooed on this heart of mine, from a dirty brown shag carpet stage. I sing my song and I pace the cage, stuck up here in the twilight zone, staring out into the great unknown. There's an old Hank Williams figurine hanging by a guitar string from the pull chain of the Pabst Blue Ribbon sign, with a clock that stopped on 9:30. Yeah, the time ain't changed round here in years. Same sad story, same old tears. There ain't nobody wants to be alone out here in the great unknown. Find a stool there at the bar, designed to take you nowhere far. They got a mirror back behind the whiskey shelves, where we don't dare look back at ourselves. And just past the men's room down the hall, barely hanging there on a plaster wall, a faded sticker on the old payphone says, "Welcome to the great unknown."
beyond the yonder star. It's all up in there where you are. By some cosmic wind we're blown out into the great unknown. Hopes and dreams and ash and dust, it all seems to either rot or rust. Souls wrapped up in flesh and bone, heartbeats in the great unknown. Again.
All right. Very nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was terrific. I got to ask you, I'm listening to you sing, and I'm looking at this guitar. It must be a story to this guitar. It's seen some days.
Well, there's way more stories to this guitar than I know. It's a 1949 Gibson Southern Jumbo.
Wow.
So it's been around a long, long time. You can see the...
Yeah.
I didn't do most of this stuff.
Oh, okay.
But there's like a guy's name carved in it here. It says like W.J. O'Neill. At some point, some guy, you know, wanted to make sure no one stole it, so he carved his name in it with a pocket knife. But yeah, it's a beautiful old guitar. I've only had it maybe 8 or 9 years or something like that, but it's my favorite.
How did it come to be in your hands?
I found this in Dahlonega, Georgia, and which is a little mountain community, and they had their own little gold rush in the 1800s, and there's a little music store there called Vintage Music, a guy named John Grimm, and I've known him for a long time. He's an old-time musician. He plays fiddle and guitar and mandolin, whatever. And has had one of those old kind of Amish-style-looking beards. And he's had that for 40 years, you know. It's not like he's part of the deal, the beard trend or anything. You know, he's saying that's just how that guy looks. But John's amazing. But he kind of... He's just one of these guys that always has old guitars in there. He's always been a collector, and he didn't really want to part with this one, and it took me a long time to get him to let go of it. So.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, normally I wouldn't bring this up. I wouldn't ask someone about their private life, but reading the bio that's gone out with the new album, there's a lot of explanation about what's been going on with you, with wives and kids, and I was just kind of astonished by that. Is it because you've been away from recording for 5 or 6 years that there was a need to explain this, or you just want your fans to know what's going on? Why so much detail?
Well, I think one of the first questions I was asked upon the bio was, where did the songs come from? And the only honest explanation I could come up with was they came from a lot of heartache and pain, and even the songs that aren't like a song like My Stupid Heart, for instance, is literally about the way one feels, or at least the way I felt, after a third marriage not working out, you know, and it was a fast one too. It was only a 6 month marriage, but we were together a couple of years, and at that point I felt really, you know, obviously you feel unsuccessful as a human in a way that you can't find a partner. I mean, that's how I started to feel, although I've had wonderful relationships with all three of my wives, and they were wonderful, and I'm in, you know, I still am good friends with two out of three of them, and I miss the other one. I would love to be in contact with her. So I think I'm kind of that way. I don't really talk a lot about my private stuff, my life that way on Facebook or any of that, and I don't tend to put it in my songs. So I thought this is an opportunity to let people kind of know where I have been for several years. That was part of it, was letting them know why there hadn't been a record. It's because my life's kind of been turned upside down, and I had to kind of figure out how to turn it back around and get it together. Although, you know, I will say this, my relationship with my son's been wonderful the whole time. I have one child, you said kids, but I do have only one kid that I'm aware of.
oh, you musicians.
And, yeah, right. Do you ever see that movie Sugartown?
Sugartown? No, I don't think so.
I think it's called Sugartown. It was a great little movie, like a little indie film. It had John Taylor from Duran Duran in it, and he was awesome. And he was in the movie, he's married to Rosanna Arquette, and he's like a, you know, kind of an aging rock star, and she's the wife of the aging rock star, and it's fantastic. There's one scene where they're talking about basically a little kid shows up at the doorstep that's been dropped off, you know, and it was a fan from like, you know, 8 years back.
Ooh.
And he like does the math, and he goes, "Wait a minute, honey, there's no way it could be that, because that was a blowjobs only tour," you know.
Oh God!
Yeah, not so much with the folk singers. We're a little bit more tame than the rockers, I guess, or at least people think we are.
Well, my advice to you is don't marry again. Just
yeah, I think you're probably right.
Live in sin. I've already told my wife that if something ever happens and I survive her, I will not marry again. I do not want everything that comes with it. I love women. There won't be any doubt that there'll be women, but there'll be no more marrying for me. So
yeah, I hear you, man.
Been there, done that, I think.
It's also kind of an old – I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing when there is a couple, when they make it work. And because I've seen that happen in my own family, my sister and her husband – they make it work, and it's just a beautiful thing, you know, and it's the right thing. And but I think a lot of times it's not the right thing. You know, men and women are very different than they were 100 years ago when marriage was just kind of coming around to being what it is. It hasn't really been around that long as we know it. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was really kind of people got married for, you know, to marry incomes together in families, or they were arranged. And that was pretty much for the same reason, for to kind of like build the wealth of a family and to put them with good stock or whatever. And, you know, so it's kind of funny to me that we still, I know it's also, you got the whole religious angle of it, and I get that, but that's not really how I look at it at this point. You can only imagine, right? Mm-hmm. After three, I'm kind of like, well, you know, maybe we're in a time, or at least I am in a time in this modern age where that's not going to really be the thing, you know, it's not going to necessarily work out.
Well, you've certainly tried it.
Yeah. Well, people's roles are very reversed or just kind of toppled at this point in marriages. So people, you know, it's hard. You have to be able to work out who's going to do what in the relationship too. You know, whose responsibility is this or that, or do we do it all together? And yeah. And a thing like me, I'm gone a lot. Mm. So, that's hard. And if you don't go with, you know, I've seen that work out where the wife or girlfriend or boyfriend or husband or whatever goes with the artist. And you know, Willie Nelson's been doing that for years where he takes the whole family out, you know. So, but he's had five wives or at least
at least, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so, but you're a guy who's, obviously, you've had your heart broken a few times. But the new songs, I mean, the songs on My Stupid Heart, I mean, an outsider, I mean, they seem to come from a guy who's still got a lot of love in his heart. These are
– Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's no – there. You know, I think, you know, a guy wants to do – I would think that going to see you on Valentine's Day would be a great thing for a guy to take his girl to. And yet, you know, we're talking about, you know, the things that have gone on. And of course, you drop in some, you know, a little zinger here and there. But you don't seem like you don't sound in the music like a bitter man about any of this.
I don't feel bitter. I don't. I mean, I feel lucky to have loved the way I have. And I do continue to love. I think that's what it's all about. And that's why I added that song, "It All Comes Down to Love," on the record.
Great song.
That is, thanks. Yeah, that's a good one. I love it. And that's a Chuck Cannon. And that's the kind of thing, that's kind of the essence of the whole record. That's really what I wanted people to get out of it. It's not really about heartbreak as it is, what do you do with heartbreak? You keep loving, you know?
I heard that song even as I was falling asleep last night. I kept hearing "It All Comes Down to Love." Who's the little child's voice at the beginning, by the way?
That's my son, Murphy. Yeah.
Well done. Yeah.
Yeah, he loved that. He thought that was so cool that he got to be on the record, you know?
I bet. That was very cool. All right, so I could keep talking forever, but I know we want to get another song in here. So
sure.
The second song you're going to play is Pre-Apocalyptic Blues.
You got it.
I didn't think I would. Is there a story of any kind behind it? It's a very striking title.
Oh, thanks. Well, Tom, who I think you met earlier, he was helping us with the with all of our production here. Tom and I have written together a bit. He plays bass and great sax player too. Great singer. He's out with me a lot on the road, and we had the chance about a year ago to write together when we had a day off and down in Florida. We were actually at the 38 Songwriters Festival, and we started watching TV at the same time. You know, it's one of those things where you either probably do one or the other. You watch TV or try to create something. But in this instant, it actually worked out pretty well because we came up with this song after watching shows like The Walking Dead and Naked and Afraid, I believe. I know Doomsday Preppers was part of what we caught while we were flipping around the channels, but there was a theme to it. And we decided that we were, in fact, living in the pre-apocalyptic period. This is, you know, right before the end. And it just kind of rolled from there. We wrote the song, you know, in the afternoon for the most part, and we just laughed the whole time. We had a ball writing it. So
it's a hysterical song. So, folks, this is Pre-Apocalyptic Blues from My Stupid Heart by Sean Mullins.
You can read it in the paper, watch it on the news. Everybody's got the pre-apocalyptic blues. You better be ready when the shit goes down. You better head on down to Costco, get you a buggy full of rice and beans, a year's supply of two-ply for your composting latrine, so you'll be ready when the shit goes down. Hesitate, don't procrastinate, or you'll all be running scared. There ain't no second chances for the bravery impaired, 'cause you know there's a couple of commies hiding underneath your bed, and the zombies gonna eat up all the brains in your head. I got a Rambo knife with a compass and a ballistic bug out bag. I got an AK-47, about 100 extra mags. I'm gonna be ready when the shit goes down. About a billion red Chinese. You say you ain't worried, I say honky please. You better be ready when the shit go down. By my jacuzzi, there's an Uzi and an RPG. Got a Stinger missile mounted on my SUV. They won't get to me no matter who they are. I got landmines buried all over my yard. 'Cause I read it in the paper, I watched it on the news, and now I got the cryptic pre-apocalyptic blues. I'm gonna be ready when the shit goes down.
Love it. It's such a fun song. I don't know how you remember the words with the RPGs and the SUVs and the, oh my God. That song, your record company needs to slip that song under the door of the producers of The Walking Dead. That would be, in, for the Fear of the Walking Dead, the prequel show, that would, they could probably slip that in, you know?
That'd be pretty cool.
That would be fun. That would be
fun.
Have you had much luck placing songs with TV or film? Because, it just seems like it'd be a great fit.
I think compared to most songwriters, I've had a ton of luck with that. You know, I mean, of course, during the Sony Columbia years, there was massive amounts of that stuff. Hmm. Yeah, they make sure that stuff happens.
Oh, good.
You know, when you're on Columbia or Sony, it's like when the Dawson's Creek show was, you know, played several songs off of the Soul's Core record. So at that time, that was one of the biggest shows around. And, you know, shows like Party of Five. And then, a couple of years back, Scrubs used my song All in My Head is one of their things. And it ended up on their soundtrack. And, you know, I've done a few film things. Most of it's been TV licensing, which has been fun. You know, Biggest Loser or Extreme Weight Loss?
Extreme Weight Loss
used the song Sunshine off of the record. Really inspiring scene. Hmm. So, absolutely, yeah, we do that. I mean, sometimes that comes from someone literally just being, at this point in my career, it seems to happen more if there's someone that likes one of my songs that's connected to the show instead of someone's pushing for it. I know that people are working for doing that. There's a couple of people that work at Round or Sugar Hill that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And that's their job. But the ones that typically actually make it onto TV shows, it's because, you know, the music supervisor loves that artist. I mean, that's almost how it works always. Or someone on the show, like Steve Carell must be, there's some kind of connection between me and Steve Carell, although we've never met. But I keep coming up in either TV shows like The Office, where he's singing my song Lullaby, which is hilarious.
Right.
Or a movie that he's in where I'm part of the soundtrack. So there, it's either him or someone that works with him, maybe his assistant. I don't know, but I'd like to find out and thank him because it's really helped, you know, having those licenses.
Well, Steve, check this out.
Maybe, there you go. Are you watching Steve Carell? I hope so.
So I don't want to completely run out of time, but I want to ask you about this tour you're on. I saw dates through at least April and May. What are some of the highlights for you? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, man, I love being out here on the West Coast where we are now. We just played a cool little place in Redondo Beach last night called the St. Rock Club. It was a pretty cool little spot. It had this real, it was an old bank from the early 1900s. It had this real woody vibe, very warm sounding room. Tuesday on the 23rd, we're doing Hotel Cafe in Los Angeles. I love the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz. We'll be back there on the 24th. Freight and Salvage, very famous Berkeley, California area coffee house, great listening space for singer-songwriters and Americana-type music, playing Freight and Salvage on the 25th. Eugene, Oregon after that. I love when I get up to Oregon, you know, that's when it starts to, I mean, I love Northern California as well. somehow there's always been a thing with me in Oregon. Like, the crowds get me and I get them, like, more than anyone else. I don't know what that is, I guess. And even the audience members, we dress alike and everything. And they're not even trying to dress like me. We just dress the same. You know, we wear flannel shirts and jeans that we bought at Target or whatever. You know, we don't give a damn. But I'm enjoying the tour a lot. And then we'll be at the Tower Theater in Bend, Oregon on the 28th. Back home to do those birthday shows, which I always wonder if I should do four nights. You know, I love doing it, but hopefully I can hold out. Four nights in a row I do that on the road sometimes too, and it's hard, you know, doing four shows in a row if you really, you know. I kind of look at it the same way James Brown did, although I don't dance like that, but I'm working real hard up there. I'm working hard up there on stage, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm hurting when I'm at the end of the thing. I'm laying down in fetal position.
Oh man.
That might be because I'm 48 now, or almost.
Well, I would think too. Four shows, the hometown kind of situation, probably a lot of work because of a lot of people you know and family and friends, and everybody wants to talk, and you have to preserve your voice. And yeah, I would think that'd be.
But I love doing it. And Eddie Owen, you know, gosh, he's been there since the beginning of my career, and he was the manager of Trackside Tavern, where Indigo Girls came out of there. You know, Michelle Malone. Kristen Hall, who ended up starting Sugarland later with Christian and Jennifer Nettles. And there was just a really great scene that came out of all that, and it started for me in the late 80s. And so Eddie now has this great place, the Red Clay Theater, Eddie Owen Presents, and we end up doing these birthday bashes, you know, where it's four nights in a row, and every night will be a little different, too. You know, one night will be solo, one night will be... actually, we're doing two nights with Ancha Dupacock, which will be great to have her. I don't know if you know her. Mm. She's a wonderful folk singer. She's great. Mm. And then you mentioned that show, the Safety Harbor Festival, I'm pretty psyched about, too.
Well, and that brings us to the kind of the last thing I want to ask you about is we have a mutual acquaintance who obviously knows you a lot better than me, but Laurie White. Laurie White. Who I first interviewed in about 1983 when she was, I believe, a kid just out of high school, had won maybe a contest.
That's great.
And then caught up again in 94, and I said, so what's new? But she produced My Stupid Heart, and of course you've already mentioned her husband, Chuck Cannon, who is a writing partner of yours. How did you guys, how do you connect with Chuck and then with Laurie?
Well, yeah, Laurie and I met through Chuck, and Chuck and I met probably, gosh, right around the time I had the song Lullaby and all that going. He opened a show for me in Nashville, and so we all met then. But it took a few years for things to settle down for me to where I was even open to co-writing it. You know, I think it was after the Thorns project that I did that I, you know, started getting back out again solo, and that's when I hooked up with Chuck again, and we started writing together. I think we met in Asheville, North Carolina, when we really kind of got together, and we were like, you know, we ought to write something, and we've been doing that ever since. That's probably been 8 or 10 years now, something like that. And so, of course, through Chuck, I met his wife, Laurie, as his wife, Laurie. And, of course, Chuck gave me a little bit of background before. He goes, man, you know, did you ever see that movie Castaway?
Right.
And I was like, yeah, I saw Castaway. And I goes, well, that's my wife at the end of the movie. And I can't remember if he gives her the box or if she gives him a box. I think he gives her a box.
Yeah.
And they're at a crossroads, kind of in the like one of those crossroads scenes.
I think he gives her the box because he's finally completing the delivery.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. He's had that box all the time. And that's Laurie White. And so she's this amazing woman. She's just amazing. She's so, so, so talented. It just... kind of on a lot of different levels too, and it's scary sometimes. But she's a wonderful producer, my favorite I've ever worked with, honestly. I mean, and I've worked with some great producers that you know their names, and they're all good. But I found her to get me as a singer and a songwriter and a deliverer of song. She got that more than anybody else has gotten it, where it's almost like another me, but a positive version. Because what happens is you start to beat yourself up in your, in the studio, and you get real, if you're not careful, it can like implode and everything can kind of, you know, turn down and negative. You can get, you can beat up yourself a lot on a singing part or how to present a song if you haven't sang it, you know, at least 100 times. Sometimes, you know, it's still, you're working out what to do. And she's the kind of person that gets you so well, at least me. She got me so well that she would go, no, it's exactly what you're doing. That's it right there. And don't be afraid to take it to the next level, which is how she got the vocal out of me in Ferguson. And it all comes down to love, all that stuff at the end where I'm screaming up high like Prince does. Mm-hmm. I didn't even think I could do that. I didn't know I could do that. I had no idea. And I've been singing my whole life. And so she goes, go for it. And I went, ah, and I kind of made my voice. And I was like, oh, wait, check this out. Boom, you know, and I was like, whoa, it's a blast. This is so much fun. And so it was, there was a freedom in working with another producer that I actually didn't, you know, part of it too, Bob, is that I didn't produce. Like, I literally kind of was like, I'm just going to be the artist. Of course, I'll have an opinion. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to let you kind of be the decision maker on this stuff. You're going to have, you know, and so, and she just took that and protected it like it was a little baby bird or something, you know. It was wonderful. Good working with her.
Well, it's funny. I, in getting prepared to do the interview with you today, I pulled up my 1994 Two Step Magazine interview with Laurie and reposted it so that we could connect it to this interview. And in that interview, 1994, she talked about how she planned to be producing music as much as she was, because she sings and she does her own thing. And she appears with Chuck. I guess they have their own act. But she intended, in 1994, she said she would be producing albums. And so it was so fascinating when I had seen in your bio, Laurie White mentioned it in there. It was just like, wow, small world.
Well, try to find another female music producer that sold 1 million records or more. Mm. You know, go check that out and see if, see what names pop up other than Laurie White. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And that's on an artist that you wouldn't even expect her to work with in a way. You know, Toby Keith, it was the best sounding Toby Keith record that's been produced. Not that I'm a Toby Keith fan by any means, but I've listened to that record in particular, and I A-beat it with other records, and it blew the other ones out of the water. So she's that level of whoever she's working with, she can tap into the sound they're trying to get and make it the best sound. You know, she's really something.
Well, nobody's going to take points away from you if you did like Toby Keith, so don't sweat that too much.
Oh, I didn't know how you felt about it. People either like it or they don't. I don't really care either way. I don't have the records, but I'm sure he doesn't have mine either.
Oh, you never know.
I doubt it.
Toby, I think you should get this one. all right, so listen, folks. You can find Sean Mullins' terrific new album, his 16th overall, My Stupid Heart, in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you are watching the show on MrMedia.com, somewhere below the video, either on the left or the right, you will see the album cover. You can click on it right now, or any of the other album covers. Click on it right now. Download the music digitally if you like, or you can order it on CD. Amazon will have it to you in a day or so. And, you know, we hope you'll do that. And, Sean, your website, I believe, is seanmullins.com.
That's right.
Right? You're on Twitter. You're on Facebook as well.
Yeah, I don't do it. I'm not real active on the Twitter, but we do the Facebook thing a pretty good bit. Yeah.
All right. Very good.
Especially when I'm on the road. When I'm at home and doing the family thing, I kind of go radio silent. But when I'm back on the road, or if there's something kind of significant going on musically, we get rolling on Facebook again. I guess it's just part of the deal now, you know.
See, now when I'm home with the family, that's when I spend all my time on Twitter and Facebook. And when I'm on the road, away from the family, I go and do fun things. But that's just me. Sean Mullins, it has been a great pleasure to have you here. The songs are wonderful. I appreciate the two live performances. And thank you so much for joining us today on Mr. Media.
Thanks, Bob.
street time. Turn not the stereo receiver. Turn your back on the deceiver. It's a bad idea to believe her. A bad idea to believe her. Turn up the stereo receiver. Turn up the stereo receiver.
Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of Sean Mullins fans who don't think there's anything wrong with the man's heart in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida.
Hey, did you ever hear, you know, Ramblin' Jack Elliott?
I know the name, yes.
All right, so Christofferson told me one time, I mentioned something about Ramblin' Jack Elliott to him, and Chris goes, you know why they call him Ramblin' Jack Elliott? And I said, well, I don't know. I figured because he was a rambling man, he traveled all the time. And he goes, yeah, that's what everybody thinks. It's because he won't shut the fuck up.
Oh, my God. Can I use that as an outtake? That's wonderful. That's a great story. Would that be a problem?
Yeah. Huh?
Would that be a problem if I use that as an outtake at the end of the show?
No.
Okay, I'd love to. I'll just splice that in at the very end of the show.